next, we would like to widen the discussion a bit and bring some more Finnish angle to it as well. So I would like to welcome Peter Victor back to the stage. And further, I would ask Associate Professor for Economics, Jan-Otto Andersson, journalist Johanna Korhonen, and Managing Director Sixten Korkman to take seats here on the stage. Welcome. Ihan miten haluatte, siihen joo, vaan niin kuin mitkä joo, tota.
So, Johanna Korhonen, you are a journalist who follows closely what moves in time. And as our previous speakers pointed out, the degrowth movement is gaining momentum all over the world. So maybe I would like to start by asking, why has the debate on growth become interesting again? And what did you learn from this morning's session?
Thank you very much for the very good question. I think the topic is of a high interest nowadays because we have very many people who are tired. They're extremely tired with their lives, with their working. They're working too much. They've got too much of everything. They are buying these things that they don't need to show something to people they don't care about, as Mr. Jackson just told us. When I was listening in the audience to these very interesting speeches, I was thinking about the question of debt, and I would like to ask a question of the audience. May I do it?
Sure.
How many of you people here have got some kind of debt? So loans from the banks to finance your housing or your studies or something that you have bought on your credit cards. Okay. And I think this is the major obstacle for making any major changes. That's what is interesting.
Okay, thank you. And then Jan-Otto Andersson, you are an economist. And so far, economic science has almost solely concentrated on boosting growth. Why there has been so little attempt to establish economics that would not rely solely on growth? And do you think the situation will change in the near future?
Yes, I think it is changing. I have this year followed the degrowth, the croissance discussions. I went to the conference in Barcelona, and everywhere here in Helsinki and otherwise, there's always full of people when we take up this theme. Yesterday was in the library in Turku, and there were a lot of people listening also. And so it is in the air. And for economics, this is a big challenge because I have been teaching macroeconomics for, should I say, 40 years. And growth has been very central in textbooks. There is a possibility of a stationary state, but that's just a theoretical thing. There is no possibility of an actual degrowth. So that's why Victor's contribution is very, very revealing and new. Now, I hope really that the economists will rethink this. But we have a growing group of ecological economics, and I think will be also affect the standard economics.
Thank you.
Next, Sixten Korkman, you are the director of the Research Institute of the Finnish Economy, and you also have a long experience from European affairs. If I recall right, you used to work as the Secretary General of the Council of Ministers for several years, and you have a vision of how the discussion is going on at European level, at least probably at global level as well. So what do you think would be the pros and cons of having a sustainable plan B to growth economy, such as those suggested by Peter Victor today?
Well, I guess to position myself so that there are foreign guests also know, I guess I have to be indeed considered to be part of this establishment and a mainstream economist of the kind who are presumably to be blamed for the mess that we are in. And starting from that position, you may imagine that maybe I'm a little bit of a dissident in this company. And so I am. I must say I was pretty unaware of the degrowth movement, and I looked at the Google yesterday and found almost 60,000 hits immediately, so I realized this is a big thing, and I was very much enlightened by the splendid introductions that I got into this topic. And then I tried to Google also a little bit what my colleagues would say within the mainstream in economics, and I didn't find a single hit, I have to say. I'm grateful, however, that Peter Victor referred to Robert Solow, one of my absolute favorites. And, of course, Robert Solow said in that quotation something which makes a lot of sense, that indeed that if incentives are right and price relations are right, then economic growth can take different shapes. Productivity may increase, but we may take more leisure. And the point, indeed, where I part company is not if we talk about sustainable growth, if we talk about green innovation, if we talk about slow growth, but degrowth. There I part company, and I consider it a bad idea, because to me, growth simply means to do new things, more clever things, better things, to change the structure of the economy, hopefully towards more services, be those social services, cultural services, whatever. I believe dematerialization is possible. You pointed to the graph showing that it didn't happen. Well, it didn't happen because we didn't try hard enough. We haven't really had any working Kyoto agreement or environmental taxes on the scale needed. If we do that, then I believe that a combination of appropriate incentives and a market economy will channel money into ecological investment, for instance. Today it doesn't happen, but if the incentives and the relative prices were right, it would happen and we could achieve much more. So where I part company is that I don't buy this degrowth. To me, that's not on. But the concerns behind this concept I very much share.
Okay.
Thank you. Do the other panelists want to reply to what Sixten Korkman just said? Perhaps briefly. Yes,
environmental economists, they think that we can be eco-efficient and sustainable by raising prices, guaranteeing ownerships to natural resources, and so on. One of the problems is, that was taken up already, we live in a very unequal world. And if you raise the price of water and food and petrol and everything, there are lots of people who cannot buy it anymore. So what you need is a combination of these higher prices and taxes with some kind of redistribution of income. And this can, on a global scale, only go so that the rich countries, in a way, give room for growth for the poor countries, and that you just to send out a crazy idea. You should have a kind of basic income globally, $1 a day each. That wouldn't cost that much, but it would be of enormous importance in some parts of the world.
Yes, Sixten Korkman would like to react, and perhaps then Peter Victor,
First of all, as far as basic income is concerned, I don't want to have it even in this country, so let's forget about that, but otherwise we're getting close, because I also do believe that if you had, on a global scale, appropriate schemes involving carbon emission trading and strong environmental taxation in combination with a redistribution mechanism to help the emerging markets, I think that would very much bring us forward. But it is, of course, the main difficulty to me is that we have a global world, both environmentally, economically, financially, in all ways, but we don't have these global institutions and we don't have the capacity for global cooperation. If we had that, then we could seriously tackle these problems. That is not possible now, but it's much more realistic than to suggest degrowth somehow as a solution, which goes much more to the fundamentals. I don't believe degrowth is compatible with a market economy. I'm not sure it's not compatible, I believe, with a welfare state of the kind with which we have fallen in love, many of us. I don't believe it's perhaps even compatible with democracy. I doubt. But I don't know enough about the topic. But I think that Tim Jackson also pointed to the fact that these are really fundamental and radical changes. So I would hope to believe that there are other routes which would bring us towards the target.
Yeah, please, Peter Victor.
I think we're all perhaps agreed that the way in which we talk about these issues is really important and the language is important. I'm also not immediately drawn to the term degrowth as applied to the overall output of the economy. But I think it's very hard to deny the relevance of degrowth when you look at the inputs into the economy. We have to reduce the extent to which we rely on the biosphere for materials and energy to support our economy. So I would hope that if we were to apply the term degrowth to a reduction in material inputs and material outputs as waste, and also to the use of the space that we share with other species, then there would be room for agreement that maybe not the word, but at least the idea of reduction in that respect would be acceptable. Second point I would like to make is of a rather different kind. Part of my experience over the years has been that whilst the pursuit of growth, as normally defined, remains a primary objective of government, it is used as a test against which other initiatives are judged. So if you want to propose some of the things that my colleague over here talked about, different kinds of environmental taxes, for example, one of the first questions you're asked is, what will that do for growth? And to me, you see, this is showing that unless you can justify the sort of the green initiative in terms of the growth agenda, you don't actually get to implement the green initiative in any significant way. So there's a more subtle problem here, and that is that unless we can divert our attention away from the pursuit of growth as traditionally defined, we won't get around to doing the things that economists have been proposing, I admit, for a long time about how to fix prices.
Johanna Korhonen.
I'm a simple citizen and a very simple journalist, and so I've got more questions than answers here. You are talking about these macroeconomic models and very big structures, but I'm looking at the whole question in a private person's level. Mm-hmm. And when I was asking about the debt level of this audience, I was thinking about the question of alternative lives, and as in fact there are quite a few people in this country too who have already done their personal decisions, which can be called downshifting or whatever. So they are working less, they got less money, but they got more time to spend with their loved ones, and they got more sleep and more ideas and everything like that. But the connection with the debt is that the one that interests me now most. Do you think, Professors Victor and Jackson, do you think that people should be getting rid of the debt first before they can, as individuals and as nations, do any major changes in their lifestyle?
Well, I agree that debt and the way that debt is created, the way that money is created through debt, is a major structural issue. I think that's been identified by ecological economists. Herman Daly has written on that subject for a couple of decades or so. So that structural issue of debt is incredibly important to address. I don't think it necessarily means that we're no longer borrowing any money for anything. I think what it does mean is, at least initially, a degree of prudence in relation to the expansion of consumer debt predicated on the growth that will then allow us to pay it back in the future. And we already saw the devastating implications of that through the financial crisis. You're asking me, should individuals do that? I think that is very hard for them to do. I do know individuals who do take that strategy and try to hold no debt whatsoever. And I'm sure that they're a lot happier than I am, and all the people who put their hands up in the audience.
Maybe you should be doing
for
the same.
That. Yeah. But it is a very, very hard thing to do. I mean, I think that was my point about fleshing out the system dynamics, the economic structure, and the social logic that has us locked into this place. My research group at the university does a lot of work looking at the motivations, the values, the attitudes, and the success of the people that you mentioned, the people who are making these choices to simplify their lives. And it's fascinating because it actually does begin to sketch a different kind of story about how to live, about the satisfactions of this alternative way of living, about the increased happiness of it, of the reduced material intensity of it. But the other lesson it shows us quite clearly is just how hard that is, even for the most well-motivated people. So I don't think we can appeal to individual change on its own. We should nurture it when we find it, but we have to have change at the level of the institutions and the systems themselves.
But there are quite a few people who would like to do something by themselves to change their own lives. Do they really have to wait for years and years before you researchers can make new macroeconomic models and before everybody understands them and before the politicians learn to know about them?
My aim as a researcher is not to figure out how people can do it, but actually to understand what is happening in the people who are already doing it. And the existence of those people says the answer to your question is yes. It is, to some extent, a choice, but we won't see, I don't think, a mainstream majority of people making that choice when all the conditions work against them. So, of course, you can do that. You can renounce meat-eating. You can sell your car. You can decide to travel by rail over ridiculous distances around Europe. You can pay off your debts and increase your savings. You can put those savings into ethical funds, and there are people who already do all of those things. And you can change your search engine to Ecosia this afternoon. I have no shares in Ecosia, by the way, but the ability, the range of very simple things that people can do is enormous.
I would have one critical question to Peter, Victor, and first I want to confess that I have been really impressed by the macroeconomic models you also presented here today. But then we are here in Finland, in this is a small country, and we have been trying to push that there would be some like political process that we would really start creating something that you could call degrowth economics. But don't you think it's a bit risky? I mean, we cannot change the global economics, can we? What would you reply to this criticism?
I don't think that's a criticism at all. let me put it differently. The global economy is in a process of transformation. And my perspective is that if we don't deliberately try to refashion it, both at the global level, national level, and local levels, in a more reasonable, coherent way, we're looking at a very, very dismal future. Mm-hmm. And so the status quo and continuance with the status quo is a most unattractive option. Mm-hmm. And so the question to me is not can we do better than we did in the last 30 or 40 years, because I don't think the last 30 or 40 years can be repeated in the future for some of the reasons that Tim said in more detail than I did in terms of materials and energy requirements and so on. And so that's really why I do the kind of work I do, is to try and lay out pictures of alternatives that look more attractive than the chaos that we may have to face if we don't address these problems. So I don't really take that as a criticism. I mean, the changes are going to happen. The question is, are we simply going to see ourselves as the victims of change over which we have no control and no role to play, or are we going to try and work as individuals, mm-hmm. do what we can as individuals, or equally important, perhaps more important, to work as groups at various levels of community to really come to grips with these problems. I much prefer the latter, and I spend quite a fair bit of time, just to embellish this a bit, talking to very young audiences, high school students, and at first they can be pretty depressed at the kind of picture we're able to lay out about the sort of world they're inheriting. On the other hand, when they begin to understand the incredibly challenging opportunities that they have for them to create new things, new institutions, new ideas, new ways of living, as opposed to simply repeating the patterns of the past, they get very excited by that. So I think, this is not always necessarily a downbeat message.
Could Stix and Korkman perhaps react to this?
I guess that I would agree that the world is on an unsustainable path. That's not where we disagree. But I think demonizing growth is not particularly helpful in this context, because it all depends on what sort of growth we are achieving, and that will depend on the policies that we hopefully could pursue at the global level. And I think that, as Peter Victor said, I think it's highly helpful to put out various alternatives and models to stimulate stimulate thinking, but we are parting company on that particular point. I can't help, and I would say to Peter that if he thinks the finance minister was receptive to his ideas. I happened to sit 2 days, one day before in the morning in the meeting of the so-called Economic Council discussing a recent report by Professor Antti Tanskanen, and the topic of which is how could we engineer more rapid economic growth in Finland in the long term. We had a very interesting discussion, and I'm quite convinced that the minister was very much into this topic. So I would put a little bit of doubts with regard to, I can't help saying to Johanna en passant that I don't understand her problem, because already today, if you reduce, you downshift, you reduce your work, you take half-time work or something like that, or you take a year off, or you take a part-time pension or something, the government is subsidizing that very heavily. Leisure is not taxed while income is taxed heavily and progressively. So, I mean, it's up to every individual. That's, to me, the virtue of our system, that each individual, in principle, has the choice. Of course, you have then to respect the fact that you have a debt, but go to the bank and tell them that we are going to longer the maturity, interest rates are very low, you can get away with it.
Why do we then have this much of unhappy and tired people?
We don't have so much. That's what if I'm allowed to say to Peter Victor, because he had this graph with happiness and GDP per capita, where, by the way, you could notice that Denmark, Finland, Sweden are up in very much in the top. But his point was that it doesn't grow with GDP. This is the so-called Easterlin paradox, which has been discussed for decades. But I've read with interest some recent articles in the Brookings Institution, which indeed, to me, question that with rather compelling evidence. They would argue that people do get happier in terms of as a positive correlation to GDP per capita, and that in fact negative growth makes them unhappy. Well, this is a controversy going on, but there is a famous American actress, Mae West, who once said that I've been rich and I've been poor. Believe me, it's better to be rich. And I'm afraid she was right.
Tim Jackson and Jan-Otto Andersson both want to comment on this, please. Sorry, Tim Jackson, Peter Victor.
The challenge before us is to have a creative and constructive debate. But it's very difficult to avoid, you know, back and forth on specific points that may seem important to us as professional economists and maybe less so to this audience. But I do have to say, I've also read the Brookings report. In fact, they do a... and you're right, there is a debate, but there's also, I would say, the majority of the research that's being done in this area is pointing to this diversion or this distinction that's made between people's sense of well-being and their increase in income. Now, whether it's a complete break or whether it's just a sort of a partial break, I don't think matters that much. The other point I wanted to make is I don't think it's a question of demonizing growth. I hope I wasn't seen as demonizing growth. I mean, my analysis proceeds from the empirical assessment of where we are, suggesting very strongly that growth of the kind we've become accustomed to is not an option. It's not supportable. It cannot be there to be had. I don't think that's demonizing. That's sort of an analytical work based upon mounting evidence. But the good news is that, and this is where I think the happiness literature can help us, even if it's not definitive, and that, and Tim, I think, supports this with his insights into prosperity, is that we can live very good, fulfilling lives without the pursuit of growth as we have traditionally done it. And that's really what we're here to discuss.
Yep, there was Jan-Otto Andersson, then Tim Jackson.
Yes, of course, it's not about demonizing growth, but one could say that growth as a major goal in a country like Finland, it may be that that's a kind of non-economic growth, that it costs more than it gives, and that you could, as an ordinary economist, actually say that we shouldn't make that much work or inputs in order to have more growth when it doesn't deliver anymore what it did. And when it comes to happiness and income, I have understood that in the short run, in 1 year or so, it's clearly so. If your income goes down, you become less lucky. Or if it goes up, you are a little more lucky. But if you take a period of 10, 15 years, and you even double your income, that does not necessarily increase your happiness at all. You could take, now in China it's difficult to do this, but easier in the United States. But I saw statistics for China where they have been trebling their national income per capita recently. But the way people are satisfied with their lives actually has not increased. That was a real paradox to me. And if it was anything, it was slightly decreasing in China, where you have this 10% a year growth.
Tim Jackson.
Yeah,
I think happiness is vastly overrated. Not vastly overrated. Actually, the Aristotle's position on happiness is called "No man happy until he's dead," which I quite like. But actually, what he was pointed to there was a different sort of concept of well-being. And what's interesting to me, and I do think we have to look at evidence in this, is that the happiness graph that Peter showed, you can replicate with life expectancy, with infant mortality, with participation in education, with almost every variable that dictates or describes human flourishing, you get a very similar pattern that where growth matters is in the poorest countries in the world. And after a certain point, actually, it can even tail off. You can have anomalies like the life expectancy in America, the UK, and Ireland is lower than the life expectancy in Costa Rica, Chile, and Cuba on a fraction of the income, and the same pattern in many other variables. And so the point here is that it's possible to achieve through different forms of social organization, through different approaches to society, through different kinds of economies, it's possible to achieve the outcomes that we want without continually running down the resources and chasing after growth. And like Peter, I don't think it's about demonizing growth. I think we could quite happily accept that it's delivered very good things, and we could accept that it matters massively in the poorest nations in the world. But that doesn't anywhere absolve us from the impossibility of continued growth everywhere across the world into the future.
Sixth and Korkman.
I think we get closer, because I reacted a little bit to the very strong emphasis given to the slogan degrowth. And also I noticed in Tim Jackson's presentation that he said that growth is unsustainable. But then when I listened to him, in fact, he said growth of the kind that we have had in the past is unsustainable. And that then we can agree, because it may be a little bit of phrasing.
Yeah, we can agree on that. But I think where we differ is that what I was trying to point out is how your option, your route out of that dilemma, if you like, is to do things more efficiently, to put the prices up, to get the signals into the market, and that the market will then deliver us rising economic growth with falling material growth. And actually, I think that is a slightly heroic belief. Unless you're prepared to look at the structure of the system, the structure of the system militates against it. So you have to be able to intervene in that structure in ways that go beyond simply expecting the market mechanism to deliver it.
I think we are all rather heroic here, because all the alternatives we are talking about are pretty radical and not easy to achieve politically for the time being. I should perhaps add also that I'm not saying that we should maximize growth, and I think few economists, I don't know, generally citizens believe that we are the kind of crazy people who believe that one should maximize growth. That's not true. Maybe politically there is an aspiration, but I guess what we want to have is a well-functioning market economy in combination with a welfare state which serves our needs, and I think that what we have in this country, like in the Nordic countries in general, is pretty decent in that respect, whether there is rapid growth or not.
Johanna Koronen.
Oh yes, about the word demonizing, which is a very exciting word indeed. I think that the state and the leading politicians and these mainstream economists, that they are demonizing at the moment the ordinary people who want to get retired at the age of 60, which is too early according to the elite. And so they are the worst criminals that we have in this economy at the moment, those people who want to get the pension at the age of 60. But of course there is this connection between the pension system and the stock market and the growth. And I've got a question for Professors Victor and Jackson. Have you been thinking about the possible impact on the pension system, which is very, very much stock market driven at the moment?
Yes, a little bit, and I referred to it in the question that I was asked just after the lecture, that we have to think about those structures of the provision of social security, including pensions, over a long period of time, and we have to have investment structures that reflect that. There are some key messages. They've been brought together quite nicely, actually, in a report, which at the moment is only in German, called Postwachstumsgesellschaft, which is a post-growth society. And they have engaged in a nice exercise of looking at pensions, of looking at health, of looking at the structure of money, looking at debt, and asking what kinds of institutional changes are needed to achieve this transition. And this is a really important thing to do. Rather than demonizing one thing or demonizing another or even arguing over impossibilities, actually creating the institutions. And there are clear messages in relation to pensions that you can say. One is that pay-as-you-go pension provisioning becomes much more difficult, and you have to therefore think about funded pensions and about the level of funding of those pensions. Another is that you have to think in different terms actually about the social contract that allows old people a decent quality of life, even though they may not have money to achieve it. You can create vehicles which exchange social services that are, if you like, a sort of separate economy, a social economy that supports people and the quality of life in their older age. So these are discussions, really, really important discussions, in which there are clear avenues of change, lots of institutional work to be done, but a great sense of possibility for doing things differently.
Peter.
Well, I haven't got much to add to what Tim said. I need to see this report. There's sometimes in the discussion about pensions an illusion that people put money aside while they're working, and then that's there for them when they're not working, and that's what their pension is. But pensions are always supported by the people who are at work. So when you are a pensioner, if you have a pension, you have a claim on the output that's being produced by the workforce that is working at that time. So in an economy that's not growing, and especially if you've got one which has a stable population with a pretty stable age structure, what you're really looking at is the necessary institutional structures that you need so that people at the different stages, before they're in the workforce, during the time in the workforce, and when they leave the workforce, have access to the output of the labor that is being employed at that time. The system we have at the moment, and I think this is what inspires your question, works in a growing economy. It's predicated on that. But that's not to say that we cannot, as Tim was suggesting, redesign the pension system so that they work fairly and equitably in an economy that doesn't rely on growth.
Sixte Korpan, and then we move to questions from the audience.
I think Johanna is now a little bit demonizing people like me unnecessarily. But I would say on this, there I differ a little bit with Peter Victor perhaps, that I don't believe that our present pension system, which by the way in this country is pretty good, I don't believe it needs growth. But it does need a reasonably high level of employment. And there we run into a difficulty. We now have a rapid change in the age structure of the population, many more people are being on pension, and life expectancy is increasing rather dramatically and continues to increase in this country and is already high. And to me that means that people, yes, should work a little bit more rather than less, as you wish, because it simply won't square. If we all want to work less, then of course we have to earn less, to get smaller wages, but also we have to be satisfied with less of the welfare service, not more, as people are asking for. So I do believe we have a problem here, but I think it's a problem which is manageable if we make sure that the employment rate is sufficiently high in this country and people accept to work a little bit longer in lifetime terms, not per week or per month, but over their lifetime.
Okay. I can see some exasperation from Tim's side, so please, shortly.
We can't solve this. It's not something you can do on the back of an envelope or in a panel session, actually. I mean, it does depend on a quite intimate knowledge of how the pension is structured, what the economies look like, what the employment level is. But I think what's missing a little bit from that response is actually the multiplicity of options that are available to create long-term economic security, even within democratic change. And some of the things that I was pointing to, some of the things in the German report that I was talking about, are opening out those possibilities, offering us different ways of structuring it, rather than simply making assumptions that that's the way we've always done it, so that's the way it's always going to be.
Yes, and now I have already seen two hands there. So please, lady in red, and then the gentleman with the red tie. Do we have the mics there? Yes. Please introduce yourself so we know who is talking.
I am Anita Kelles-Viitanen from ATTAC Finland, and first of all, I want to thank you for your very inspiring presentations and also inspiring discussion. I want to bring the issue back to the people. There are many people, and I think numbers may be now in hundreds of thousands, who are not going to wait when you economists decide whether it's going to be zero growth, deep growth, low growth, whatever. They have already taken future in their hands, and they are having experimentations in all countries, various kind of they are experimenting with greener and ethical lifestyles, transition downs, solidarity economies, communal living, non-profit cooperatives, time banks, and other community exchange systems with local money or with no money. And my question to you is, what you see future of this kind of experimentation, and how we can link it to this financial and structural and social change that we need to have? Thank you.
Should we take two questions and then answers? Yeah. So also the gentleman with the red tie. There, the back. Yeah, there was actually two red ties.
I have a red tie, yes. Okay. Hello, I am Santeri Ulkuniemi from Tampere. There is a well-known contradiction between labor and capital. And I want to ask you that according to, because I have understood that the capital is always growing, in order to have a degrowth, should we get rid of the capital?
Yeah, please then answer, whoever wants to react to two questions raised. And then we have the another gentleman with the red tie.
Well, what wonderful questions. The experimentation that you described is, of course, exactly what we want and is to be encouraged. And you're quite right. Why would people wait for funny kinds of folks like us academics to sort of rule on what's going to work and what isn't? We don't know the answers. What we try to do is feed the debate, feed the discussion, and hope that it has some impact, some useful impact. I am personally encouraged by a lot of the experimentation that I either see or in touch with or read about. I don't see, though, that it's having any measurable impact on the sorts of things that we do measure about how the economy is functioning. So it's important that happen, but there is this question of scale. It needs to be scaled up. The other thing I would say is, and this is perhaps where academics can play a role, we need to ensure that we learn as much as possible from these experiments. Some are good, some are not going to work out. We need to know this, and we need to make sure that this information is being circulated, and that is a role that we can play. You asked a question about how various systems can be integrated with the current system. I mean, I took a look recently at a local currency system, the Berkshire system in the States, and was very impressed to be able to visit quite a significant town and actually spend a local currency in a store. I'd read about it, but it wasn't until I actually did it that I had that kind of tingle of, oh, isn't this exciting, something different here? And I began to understand how it worked, and it blends with the mainstream financial system. But it's still a very peripheral activity. As to the question about labor and capital, well, thank goodness you asked that. I don't have an answer to it. I'm struggling with this myself in my work on managing without growth. I ducked the question about whether it would be consistent with capitalism or not, not because I didn't realize it was a fundamental question because of what you're talking about, the conflict between labor and capital, but there's not much point in writing about it unless you've got something useful to say about it. So I'm now considering these issues and working on these issues, but I haven't reached a conclusion yet.
Any other reactions?
I love the work of ATTAC. I love the transition towns movement. I love all that grassroots stuff. I think it's tremendously important. And I suppose I see two possible scenarios of change. One is that that work that experimentation becomes the basis for a better way of living, because it's recognized by those in power and by structures of governments as a real social experiment of enormous value. And the other is a place where that value isn't recognized. And the social movement towards change grows and grows, the dissatisfaction grows and grows, inequality itself grows and grows, financial security is reduced for millions of people, not just hundreds of thousands, and that movement becomes actually aggressive. And to me, that is exactly why it's worth working with policy to change the structure of the institutions to allow the flourishing of those initiatives. I think it's a very important point. And my urging to policymakers is to take that seriously, because as a social movement, it's quite unique, and it is a place pointing towards the future. And my urge towards those who are engaged in those grassroots initiatives is to work for political change, because I do think there's a point at which that could create, otherwise could create a quite unpleasant transition in which conflict becomes the order of the day. On the capital question, I actually think that this division, the conventional, the historical fight between labour and capital has changed significantly. And I think the distance to the openings for us to change the system are all precisely about the way in which that relationship between capital and labour has changed and could change in the future. Does capital matter? Do stocks of things matter? Do assets matter? Yes, they clearly do. But does the prerogative of capital to distribute the surpluses from productive assets matter? Actually, I think we have to seriously examine that. We have to go back to that argument, if you like, about the prerogative of capital, and we have to create structures which mediate that 100-year battle between labour and capital and create different ownership structures that no longer rely on us having a class distinction as the basis of an ideological war which prevents us actually making structural changes of the kind that we need.
Sixth Corporal.
I believe also great in diversity and experimentation. As to this capital-labour question, I think it's intriguing theoretically in a way that is, if you assume in the extreme, then, that we would be talking about permanent negative real rate of growth, is that compatible with a market economy? I guess it in the long term might mean then that the real return on capital would be negative. So the capitalists would get poorer and poorer, but then who cares?
And now I have in my list at least four questions, and we have some 10 minutes or a bit less. Yes, there's actually first the gentleman with the blue sweater, and then there is the gentleman with red tie who was actually first. Yes, and then there are two ladies, one with the orange sweater and one with the orange gown, and then yes, one there as well. So at least these questions we can take.
Okay, thank you. My name is Janne Korhonen, and I'm from the Aalto University School of Economics, and thank you for the very interesting presentations. Especially thanks to Professor Victor. I hope you showed those slides on the oil peak to the Minister of Finance, because I heard a rumor that last year that was the concept that fossil fuels are going to run out someday was still news to the Economic Committee of our Parliament. Maybe Mr. Korkman might comment on this, but anyway, you were talking about the importance of the stabilizing population growth as a precondition of degrowth, basically. I fully agree with you. This is a very important concept. But given that it looks likely that we're going to face the oil peak, and there are many reasons why there's a high probability of long-term economic recession following that, what kind of political and social problems might you foresee if we hit the declining economy at the same time as we have this increasing population, so that the average GDP per person is declining? I would also have a second comment on that, but it's a little bit politically incorrect, so I might not put it in here. It relates to the discussion about the immigration policies here in Finland, but maybe I'll leave it for later.
Yeah, and then the gentleman with the blue sweater. So perhaps we take two questions now and then the rest later on.
Yeah, my name is Linus Atara. I'm a journalist. I'm basically just interested in knowing whether this degrowth thing, is it, are you specifically not making a demand on the Western governments? Are you making a demand on the Western governments that now enough is enough? Or is it extending to a global, global economy? Because there are a lot of economies in the world that still depend on growth in order to be able to reduce poverty. And this is what we're talking about. And so what is the link between what you're saying now and then poverty reduction? The other issue is also that you mentioned earlier on, Victor mentioned something which was very interesting about the institution that would resist, you know. I have in mind here the Tobin tax. Nobody talks about it until now, an economic crisis, you know, comes over. Now, somewhere after the, during this financial crisis, Tobin tax has now, you know, become such a fashionable thing. Now, this degrowth thing, when, as it is gathering steam now, when it gets to a critical point of implementation, for instance, now, who, where would we really see the villains, you know, trying to obstruct policy implementation, for instance?
Thank you. Yeah, I need to ask all the people be rather brief, both in questions and answers, because we have actually now less than 5 minutes. So, yeah, but please.
Well, I'll answer the first question, yeah, and maybe let Tim or someone else answer the second one. You asked about peak oil leading to economic decline, and in relation to a stable population would mean a declining per capita income. That's one possible scenario. Look, I did my empirical work for the country that I live in, Canada, and it's pretty clear that, you know, you just can't generalize from one country to another and say, well, what works there would automatically work somewhere else. So the situation in Canada is not maybe as threatened by that scenario as other countries might be, because we produce oil as well as we consume it. But where it gets tricky, and I think, you know, your notion about being politically incorrect, it applies as well in Canada. I'm an immigrant to Canada. The way Canada would stabilize its population is through immigration, because within a few years, virtually all of the population growth in Canada will be driven by immigration. There's no internal degenerated population growth anymore. I looked pretty deeply at that question and discovered that most of the immigrants that Canada tries to bring in are the wealthy, the highly educated, the people who in their countries that they come from, mostly from the south, could play perhaps a productive role there. We're poachers, you know, and we get complaints. We get poorer countries saying, we need our doctors, we need our engineers, we need our nurses. We need them more than you do, and yet you're taking them. So there's a very tricky issue here about it. But we have, as a matter of policy feasibility, within our hands to stabilize the population in Canada. We'd still be poachers, but to a lesser degree. So that's the Canadian situation. What it might be like in Finland would require some work focused here.
Yes, and then there were...
I do think it's really important to answer that second question, and both Peter and I have made absolutely clear that actually that our messages are messages to the richest, most developed nations to come up with a different kind of economic model, and that the responsibility for that is driven actually by the need to make room for growth, make room for development where it really matters. And there's lots of questions that you could ask about the form of that development, but certainly what we're arguing about is the responsibility for those who already have enough, rather than saying to the developed world, no, you can't have any income growth. That's really important to say. Having said that, you know, there is an interest, a surprising interest in these ideas in some of those countries, because they have a genuine national interest in creating economies that don't necessarily follow the Western model and try to achieve something different. And your second point about who are the villains of the peace, resisting taxes, resisting the Tobin tax, resisting the carbon tax that almost managed to get under the wire in France over the early summer and then was undermined. Were there villains? Who were the villains? What was at stake in that resistance to these measures? And again, Peter did allude to that, but it's worth just pointing it out again. can we really vilify, should we demonize even government in the fact that they resist these measures if they are seen to confront economic growth? Because at the moment, economic growth is the default mechanism for economic stability. Economic stability ensures social stability. Social stability surely matters and is a responsibility of government. So perhaps no surprise that while we are still driven by a growth-based model, government continues to counter the kinds of measures that we need to change the system. So I think that's a deep responsibility to open out the ideas and not necessarily to demonize growth or to demonize those who have defended growth, but simply to say we need a structural change in the system and we can't get it while we're just fetishizing growth.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps now the lady in the orange sweater and then the lady with the orange gown there in the audience. And perhaps also the last question we had, that was still promised. So we take all three, and then we'll have the answers, and then we leave for lunch.
Hello, my name is Nina Jaakkola. I would just like to clarify, hasn't the increase in productivity been based largely on growing energy consumption, and is the increase in productivity necessary in your degrowth models? And if so, how do you do it without increasing energy consumption?
Yes, and please, there was the lady with the orange gown.
If I read from paper, so it goes more
please
fast.
Please, speak up, please.
Yeah, I wrote it up, so I read it more quickly. My name is Didi Annapurna, and I'm from Proudest Universal. Human being is not only physical, psychic, and economic being, but also spiritual being. For example, yoga and meditation is spreading all over the world like silent revolution. Yoga and meditation is easy way to get free from materialism and be happy. Is this worrisome development or welcome? You are most welcome to our seminar tomorrow, yoga and meditation. Thank you for that.
Okay, final Thank question, you. Please.
Yeah.
I'm Jörn Ekström from Deep Ecologic Association in Finland. I think my question is more a comment, but about the transition of the growth from material to service, cultural service, social service, and so on. I think there can be a shift of a part of the economic from the material to the service. But the question is that can the service either grow forever?
Mm. Thank you, yes.
So who would like to comment this? First question about increasing energy consumption versus degrowth. Yeah. Peter.
The question was about the relationship between energy and growth. I think it's an excellent question. There's a recent book by Robert Ayres and Ben War, perhaps that's inspired your question, maybe not, but on this very, very issue of the relationship between cheap energy and economic growth. And they make a very, very powerful argument that we are looking at the end of cheap energy, and in so doing, we'll be looking at the slowing down and possibly inevitably of degrowth for that reason. I haven't fully digested their work, but what I'm planning to do right now is to build in energy much more explicitly into my own model so that I can more fully investigate that. So I absolutely appreciate your point and your concern, and I think there's something very, very important that you're pointing to. And it can very well sort of change the debate, because it may be strengthen the debate, because what it does, it says that, the kind of growth we've had, if it's correct, based as it is on cheap energy, cannot continue for that reason alone. And then we need to understand what the implications are, what the alternatives are, what our room for maneuver is. But if we sort of turned our backs on it and say, well, that's not happening, or we don't have to think about it, then we will be in no position to deal with it rationally when the time comes. The second issue, I think, as far as I could hear it, I'm sorry, I didn't hear it all, the sort of the spiritual dimension versus the material dimension, I think that's fully consistent with some the sorts of things that Tim and I have been trying to say, and that is that we can understand that lives can be fulfilling once material needs to a certain level have been reached, and that fulfillment comes therefore from the non-material. It's not such a clear dichotomy, but I think that's highly consistent with what we've been trying to say. And the last point was about, can we have continual growth in the economy if all we have is services? Well, this is something that I have actually looked at quite carefully. It's pretty clear that there isn't a single service that you can buy in the economy which doesn't have some material and energy component to it. And so the answer is no. You just can't. I mean, you could go for longer if you were a purely service-based economy, but there is a material and energy substructure to every service-producing activity that's bought through the market. So that's the answer I'd give to that.
I think one of the sources of this degrowth literature is the Club of Rome's report, The Limits to Growth, in the early 70s, which I remember having read as a student. And I think personally that there are no limits to growth. And by that I mean that growth is a function of scientific discovery, of the increase in human knowledge, leading to innovations which change the structure of GDP. It's not about producing more or the same stuff. It's about increasing in human knowledge. And if you have the right incentives in place and the right places, I believe it's possible to achieve huge transformations which meet many of the aspirations. I don't claim that we are on the road. I don't claim this is realistic. But that, I think, is growth is without limits.
Tim.
Tim, yeah.
I believe I can teletransport myself home to London as soon as lunch is finished with no carbon whatsoever. We do have to pay attention to the natural resources, and the natural resources were clear in creating the productivity that produced growth. And when you ask the question about the natural resources in relation to materials, the same thing is true. Actually, the economists, and there's a very well-known argument in economics by someone called Baumol, it's called Baumol's theorem, is that if you change an economy from products to services, you slow down growth. The only way we got out of that in the last 10 years is by creating a service sector in the financial industry, which was the massive monetary expansion that led us to instability. But in the services that we're talking about, actually there is a tendency to slow down growth by that transfer into services for exactly the reasons that I mentioned to you before. It is the value of human labor in those services that creates the value to consumers. And so typically the gains that you can have from labor productivity improvement by putting ticket machines in instead of people at stations just aren't available to you when it comes to the services from doctors, from social care, from leisure, from renovation and so on. So I think the answer to that question is no. On the religious spiritual question, yes, I mean, I think what you're asking in its most fundamental form is who are we? What kind of beings are we? I think to me it's abundantly clear that we are not just material beings and we're not just materialist beings, and the kind of conception of our material aspirations in those forms is a severe constriction on our own nature as human beings. So I do think there's a huge part of this agenda which is about opening out to who we fundamentally are. And although I personally struggle with any particular form of spirituality, I certainly think that at the limits of our knowledge of the psychology and the interactions between human beings, there's something that we still haven't grasped about it, what it actually means to be alive. And there's lots of movements that are exploring this. There's a lovely one which is just called Breathe, which is a very good thing to do and really doesn't require that much in the way of material possessions, but makes you feel a lot better. And, so I kind of try and practice it sometimes.